A brilliant, tragic father felled by a monstrous social injustice, Ronald Reagan's firing of striking air traffic controllers in 1981.
He's a very tragic figure, yeah. And living with him, growing up with him, and even talking with him, he would never have seen himself that way, and I certainly didn't recognize him that way, and it's only in hindsight and with my literary eye was I able to recognize the epic potential of that story.
That's Gregory Pardlow. We talk with him about his searing family memoir, Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. Then, is New York State poised to pass the most ambitious Green New Deal plan in the country? We talk with economist Robert Pollan about the Climate and Community Protection Act. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. In the annals of modern American labor history, few events are more notorious than the 1981 PATCO strike, the strike by the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization that pitted the union against newly inaugurated President Ronald Reagan. Reagan broke that strike by tearing up a long-accepted social pact of negotiation. Instead of negotiating with the strikers, he fired them all, then blacklisted them from working in the industry ever again. Many think it was the beginning of the end of the power of the American labor movement, or at least the 20th century chapter of it. But the PATCO strike and its outcome didn't just decimate the labor movement. It devastated the families of the striking workers, men who had dedicated their lives to a highly skilled, extremely demanding, and well-paid job that was difficult to replace. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow tells the story of that devastation in his powerful memoir, Air Traffic. For African-American men like his dad, who was a union leader as well, bouncing back after the loss of their jobs was made even more difficult by the barriers posed by a racist society. But Air Traffic isn't only about the PATCO strike's impact on Pardlow's family. It also chronicles the triumphs and tragedies of several generations of family history. It's a richly realized ode to one man's remarkable father, to fatherhood, and to the frustrating yet redemptive ties of family. Gregory Pardlow's collection Digest won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. He's poetry editor of Virginia Quarterly Review and teaches in the graduate writing program at Rutgers Camden University. Air Traffic was published by Knopf in April 2019. Gregory Pardlow, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca.
I just want to say right off the bat to my listeners that this was just a beautifully written book. The language is absolutely stunning. So I want to thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Now, you are actually Gregory Pardlow Jr., which you don't put on, you don't call yourself that.
Very pointedly, yeah.
Exactly. Your father is a huge presence in the book. He died just as you were finishing Air Traffic, this memoir. Why did you start the book with him?
Well, actually, originally I did not start the book with him. He died after the book was done, but before it was published. And so that interim period actually had a lot of influence over me sort of rearranging the book. Mm-hmm. So that first section was the last section that I wrote, and it was written in hindsight. But originally, the book was, my intention was to write about the strike, I interviewed my father, I interviewed my grandfather to just sort of create a family narrative that I could feel secure in. You know, I think I was admiring of people who, you know, I'm not a religious person particularly, but I'm admiring of people who are born into religious families who have a very clear narrative identity, right? And, you know, this is who we are. These are the rituals we have. And I felt like my family, we didn't have any organizing rituals or practices or ways to talk about our experiences that connected them to one another. And I saw air traffic control as potentially being providing that narrative. And so that's what I set out to do. And what ended up happening, as you're noting, you're pointing out, was it became a book very much about my relationship with my father and my admiration for my father, my frustrations with him, and everything in between.
Yeah, he's really a figure larger than life. You write that your dad favored potential over humility, and yet despite him having great potential, great skills, he suffered great humility. He's kind of a tragic figure.
He's a very tragic figure, yeah, yeah. And, you know, and living with him, growing up with him, and even talking with him, he would never have seen himself that way, and I certainly didn't recognize him that way. And it's only, as I say, in hindsight and with my literary eye, was I able to recognize, you know, the epic potential of that story, and just how tragic he was. And so I was very much aware that the strike itself was a tragic moment, you know, at this turn in his fortunes. But I didn't want to read too much into it. So it's interesting, though, that despite my resistance to glamorizing him or pathologizing him or even condescending to him in a literary sense, despite my resistance to doing any of those things, he still comes out as this, as you say, larger than life figure. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, if it's something to be proud of, or, and I'll tell you, I have this sense that I'm a little wary of readers taking over his character and sort of making him into something other than a guy who just wanted to work and, you know, barbecue on the weekends and, you know, take his family on vacation once a year. So there's these warring forces in my rendering of him.
Yeah, and I also think you put him within an important theme. And listeners, we are talking about the memoir Air Traffic by Gregory Pardlow, but also about the impact of the PATCO strike, the air traffic control strike in 1981, which we'll get to a little bit later, because you really do situate his story and even the story of that strike within a whole range of family history. You start in the early part of the book, you talk about a grandfather of yours and about a history that I think most of us don't know, that before Woodrow Wilson, black people, at least black men, held fairly high positions in the federal government. So tell us about your grandfather and about that history.
So I started out, you know, like I said, one of the, I don't know if it was a mission in the book, but certainly one of the impulses in my writing was, again, not to glamorize anyone in the book. I didn't want to make the story more than anything, you know, more than just the story of an American family encountering ups and downs. And as I spoke to my grandfather, interviewed my grandfather before he passed in 2013, I think it was. The stories that he shared with me were pretty amazing. And again, my impulse, my inclination was to say, here's another, you know, story of black triumph over racism and, you know, and this, a story of perseverance through hardship. And, you know, the more I thought about it and the more I researched, the clearer it became to me that there was nothing unique about my grandfather's story. And I think we tend to make these individual stories unique, as if they were outliers, as if there weren't people you know, all across the country, day in and day out, contending with these forms of racism and oppression and just these sort of daily obstacles to dignity. Mm-hmm. And so in researching my grandfather, I'm thinking about what was his experience. He went to Oklahoma City to the academy. He was an engineer, but they, of course, he couldn't be called an engineer because he was African American, and the other engineers would not want to be set on the same rank as an African American. And so my grandfather had this kind of shadow experience of going through the academy where he wasn't allowed to eat in the mess hall. He had to bring his lunch, and in fact he had to eat under the awning outside because he wasn't allowed inside the mess hall at all. He couldn't take the bus on the grounds, and so he had to walk for many miles, and if he, you know, so the transportation was a crazy situation. And the more I research the everyday life of Oklahoma, I come across this story, which I'm frankly ashamed to say I had heard only in passing, and I'd heard that the Tulsa riots of 1921, you know, just sort of vague reference. There's this thing that happened. And it was the first aerial attack on U.S. soil. It was the oil barons of Tulsa dropping flaming balls of tar on the wealthiest, at the time, the wealthiest African-American community in the country. And I was appalled, shocked, and horrified. But again, what I think I might have overlooked in that story was the fact that you had this very successful, you know, middle class and upper middle class community before, like I said, before Woodrow Wilson. And actually, it was around the time of Woodrow Wilson, around the time of the First World War. You know, so and then in researching, well, how common, you know, what is the story? We tell ourselves a story that African Americans have always had occupied this menial rank in American history, and to a large extent, obviously, that is the case. But we don't acknowledge the fact that those menial ranks were thwarted and overcome at various points in our collective American history. And there were, you know, numbers of times when the African-American community could have been, you know, left to its own devices, could have been thriving for generations by now, were it not for the overt actions of people afraid of, well, black economic independence.
Now, are we talking about your, I might be confused, are we talking about your grandfather, your great-grandfather, who actually had a position in Woodrow Wilson's government?
No, so this is the history that I'm tracing backwards. So what is the environment in the 1940s and 50s when my grandfather goes to Oklahoma City to train for what was then the CAA, the Civil Aeronautics Administration, which would become the Federal Aviation Administration. When he goes there to train, my question is, what is the environment, what is the cultural and historical environment that he is stepping into? And it had only been 20 years prior that the Tulsa race riots occurred, in which these oil barons used their airplanes to drop these flaming balls of tar on a thriving black community. And so my grandfather, you know, going into the aviation industry, is going to study at a place where there is this horrendous history, this awful history. And so I just wanted to contextualize what his experience, you know, so there were certainly people there who remembered the race riots of 1921 very clearly. And there were certainly people there who were aware of the thriving black community. And so my grandfather, as one of the first African Americans to work to have a position of engineering rank in the FAA, would have been seen as a considerable threat, and indeed he was.
Yeah, and you know, you subtitled this memoir, Gregory Pardlow, you subtitled Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. So what we, you know, see, as you've indicated here, is a history of ambition, of striving for success, of getting a toehold, and then losing it to the relentless impact of racism. And this tradition continues then with your dad. So Tell us about your dad and, you know, how he became an air traffic controller.
So my father had a full scholarship to college, which he gave up because he got his girlfriend pregnant. And that was my mother, and the child that they had was me. And much to the ire of all four of my parents ran off and eloped. And when they returned, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, this is, who at that point was now working for the FAA, was fully, you know, embedded in the administration, had a program where he was helping African American men, minorities, and women was the phrase. Prepare for the federal standardized test. And my father, being young and smart and a new father and husband, my grandfather reached out to him and said, you know, I know you need a job. Why don't you come and take my class and see if you can get into air traffic control? And so my father, very much needing a job, but nonetheless resenting his father-in-law's, what he saw as gratuity, charity, refused to take my grandfather's test and refused to take his class, in fact, and just took the test on his own. And he did well, and he passed, and he got into the air traffic control. But they always had this tense relationship. Now, you point out that part of the story that I'm dealing with is how generation after generation, we are all, and I'm specifically interested in masculine ambition because of the problems, the specific problems that it poses, because for an African-American man to pursue what is already toxic masculinity often ends up just compounding problems, because it is a threat to the larger society. It is harmful to the intimacies within the home, and so the paradox of ambition and black masculinity, you know, and how that often turns in on itself was a thing that I was interested in. I'm trying to get back to this idea, though, that it's not just racism that thwarts these narratives of what would be success, potential success. It is certainly also the internalized, and I guess in a sense maybe that is consistent with racism, internalized sense of futility and the narratives of the sort of frustrations that we're aware that African American men face on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And so my father, in a way, as I look over the story of his life, he's playing out this story in which, in some senses, he's responsible for, in some senses, there's a structure that keeps him from achieving altogether. But there are several points in his life at which he gets in his own way. And so he gets kicked out of Central High School for truancy. He gets his girlfriend pregnant when he has a full scholarship to college. He goes on strike against the advice of his father-in-law, and his father-in-law, who told him this is a setup. They are going to fire every one of the 13,000 air traffic controllers who go on strike. And my father, very headstrong nonetheless, you know, followed through with it.
And he was in a position, I mean, he was in a position of authority in the union.
Yeah, and one of the questions I'm asking is, to what extent did he have a choice? To what extent do any of us have a choice in the, you know, because there are responsibilities and obligations that go along with the roles that and positions that we occupy in society. And him, my father, as a union, as a spokesperson for the union, he really did not have a choice but to strike and to go down with the ship, so to speak. Yeah, and the impact of that was that I internalized a sense of futility and distrust of institutions, and I struggled for a long time with my own relationship to success, just to put it in the biggest abstract sense.
Yeah, so let's talk about that strike and the impact of it, because I remember it well, and I knew at the time that it was a death knell for American labor, which is in fact what it turned out to be. But I think most people do not know about PATCO and the strike. So tell us what happened.
So this is, again, you know, much like I was saying about the Tulsa riots, there's a story that is kind of out there, and some people have heard about it a little bit, but it's not entirely clear, and it's not something that we talk about. And it was surprising to me as I started, talking to people about this project of writing this book and talking about the strike. There were the people who lived through it and paid attention to it at the time knew it very well, like yourself, you know, and understood the importance of it. But the vast majority of people I encountered, you know, the response was, oh, yeah, there was that thing. What happened with that? And it was just shocking to me because it was such a pivotal point, turning point in labor history, American labor history. So the air traffic controllers felt overworked. They were using equipment from the Second World War. They did not have regular shifts, so they were working rotating shifts and six-day work weeks. And, of course, they felt they weren't getting paid what they deserved. And I think, you know, there's this undercurrent, this subtext of striving for dignity that is going throughout the book. And I was also interested in how the air traffic controllers wanted to be seen as a professional organization. They wanted their work to be understood for the important role that they played.
And as you point out, it is an incredibly difficult job and takes an inordinate amount of skill and attention.
The training itself, 50%, at least the 50% of people get washed out at the academy, just in the training process. The job is extremely stressful. You're literally holding people's lives at the tip of your tongue, and it's an incredibly important position for the safety of our nation. And so the air traffic controllers were negotiating with the federal government for a better contract and all of the things that I point out. And Reagan was campaigning at the time. This was just before Reagan was elected. And President Carter apparently was not as responsive as PATCO wanted him to be. And Reagan, as a campaigning in his campaign for president, said, you know, if the union supports me, I will recognize how important you are to this country and the role that you play, and I will do my best to make sure that you get all of the resources that you need to do your jobs efficiently. So the union supports Reagan. Reagan gets elected. Probably not as a direct cause, but they contribute to Reagan's election. And Reagan then, when PATCO approaches Reagan for, you know, to make good on his campaign promises, he kind of turns his back on them. Mm-hmm. And so they threaten the strike. And as this new president, Reagan cannot he cannot allow himself to be seen as having been pushed around by this union, right? And so you have these colliding forces. There's a great book called Collision Course about the strike, but you have these two forces that neither one of them really can bend, the force of the union and the force of this incoming president, who is standing his ground and making his maintaining his stature. And so when they threaten to strike, the federal government calls their bluff, and no one really expected that the government would the PETCO expected the government would recognize the importance of the air traffic controllers and immediately say, yes, you're right, please don't strike, we can't do without you, here's everything you need. Right. But we know that wasn't the case. Reagan said, sure, try it, buddy, go ahead. And so when they did ultimately go on strike, August 1st of 1981, President Reagan came out into the Rose Garden and said, this is in fact an illegal strike. There was a statute that says federal employees can't strike, and although that many unions had actually gone on strike and hadn't without any repercussions, but Reagan uses this statute to say you're all now outlaws, and not only if you don't come back to work in 48 hours, not only will you have forfeited your jobs, but you will be prosecuted.
And blacklisted.
Absolutely, yeah. So, in the people in PATCO, there's this hubris, back to our Greek tragedy, themes of Greek tragedy, there's this hubristic thought that there's no way he could possibly fire 13,000 federal air traffic controllers. The system would shut down globally. And in fact, he fired. That's exactly what they did. They fired them all and kept the system running through skeleton crews. They brought in people out of retirement. They brought people out of the military. They reduced the number of flights drastically. And one of the painful ironies is that in the process of restoring the system to safety, they ended up instituting many of what PATCO, the original demands of PATCO. So they reduced the working hours, they stabilized the shifts, they reduced the number of flights, they updated the equipment, right, and all that. So the union got everything it wanted for the workers who would ultimately replace them.
Yeah, and just to the point on the impact that this had, I mean, as you point out, striking against the federal government had been illegal but tolerated. Mm-hmm. This had a much wider impact, because what it did is it made it okay, much in the way that Trump is, demolishing norms
today.
Of the rule of law, and then, that norm is gone, now we're doing mm-hmm. something different. Mm-hmm. This had the same impact on how employers responded to strikes.
That's really well put, yeah.
Now they could just replace striking workers. Mm-hmm. Just so people understand the difference, when I was growing up as a kid, my mother, who went through the Depression, always told me whenever we saw striking workers, you never cross a picket line. My mother was not a political person. She was not in the labor movement. She'd never mm-hmm. been in a union. But she knew you don't cross a picket line.
She respected the dignity of the workers, right?
Exactly. And after Reagan and PATCO, that all went by the board.
To the extent that now we think of, unions are not blameless in this. I think there is a public relations problem that unions have particularly the larger unions. But it does amaze me that today we can talk about unions as if they are the problem, that you know, they are preventing, you know, this idea of a right to work, that they are, the unions are preventing Americans from, you know, from getting jobs and from pursuing the American dream. And it's just astounding to me how that message has been distorted and turned on its head.
Yeah, I mean, right to work, a truly Orwellian term.
A truly Orwellian, exactly.
Now, Gregory Pardlow. We'll talk more with him about his memoir, Air Traffic, after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're back with poet Gregory Pardlow, talking about his new family memoir, Air Traffic. There's so much we don't have time to cover in this book. I mean, there's a whole personal story that, you know, is outside of the PACO strike, which is really fascinating. And you talk about issues of mental illness in your family and in yourself as well, that we really don't have time to get to. But what I found so interesting is how this book talks about the themes. You say the dignity of work. It's also the dignity of identity, the dignity of humanity. So how class and race intersect in this history of the American dream and the African-American reality. And what I want to, you know, so much today there's this talk among political pundits and the media that posit a binary choice between appealing to voters on issues of economic justice versus identity issues and issues of social justice. How do you see that? Is that really an either or? How does that apply to you know, your own history as a family?
I see it as a false binary, certainly, and it's so dangerous within our identity communities and objectively across identity communities. It is such a dangerous proposition to say, I disavow this structure of thought. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is to imagine a way of respecting the family, respecting the emotional and affective ties that create communities, the shared ambitions that maintain communities, how we do that toward political equality, just issues of equity in general, how do we maintain those communities without imposing this rule of racial distinction, of gender distinction? So I've been thinking a lot lately about this idea of intersectionality. And I'll try to be really, really brief about this. But the thing is, it came about through, there was a woman who, an African-American woman, who was complaining that she was being discriminated against in her workplace. But the court said, well, the workplace respects African-Americans, and the workplace respects women. So you don't get, you know, two bites at the apple, so to speak. And this woman argued that, well, no, there's this unique position where the two intersect, and I am not being represented. My interests are not being protected at that intersection. And I think one of the problems that we have as a society in general is that we will recognize and respect one another only on very specific terms. You know, so I will acknowledge and respect you as an African American. I will acknowledge and respect you as a queer person, or go down the list. But we don't have a way of talking about ourselves in multidimensional ways, mm-hmm. and ways that respect the fact that my sense of myself as a political person and a person belonging to a variety of communities, those interests do not respect the boundaries of race and gender and sexuality and class. So how then do I celebrate my friendships, my loves, my sense of commitment to people, regardless of those boundaries. And so there is a sense. I'm not quite sure what the answer is beyond sort of challenging the structure of, for example, racial identity. But I am confident that the first step is to say the structure itself is an imaginary thing, and we don't have to participate if we don't have to follow its rules at all times. We can choose to follow them sometimes and choose not to at other times. And I recognize very much how even suggesting, that I don't buy into race, just saying something like that, is terribly threatening to a lot of people, regardless of race, right? Because we're so invested in having created these structures that we don't have a way to ever step out of them and just interact with one another as people. Americans or, whatever larger sense of community we might want to construct.
Yeah, I think that's well put there. To me, it kind of just boils down to respect. I mean, let's respect our common humanity and let's respect our interesting differences.
Yeah, I wish it were.
Yeah, that's
but that,
true.
Right, that's simple. it sounds so easy, but I think the reason is, we have these kind of tribal affiliations that the story, you belong to a tribe in order to distinguish yourself from the other tribe. So even there's a sense that, as I was talking about the force of the incoming Reagan administration and the force of the PATCO Union, there's a way in which these communities and identities and categories of identity are not allowed to simply respect one another. They exist in order to be at odds, in order to be adversarial.
So are you saying that first we have to interrogate these tribal definitions? In other words, it's not just enough to say I respect you. There has to be a deeper learning.
There has to be a deeper learning. There has to be a historical learning. And that, one of the things that I am kind of terrified by, is the lack of historical awareness that we have as a culture, myself included. I'm certainly not putting myself above it. The situations that we encounter today are a direct result of, in some cases, very overt and orchestrated decisions, political decisions, and in some cases, just a kind of, benign neglect. But the idea that we're facing these things for the first time and that there's somehow, I think I come back to this your suggestion that wouldn't, if only we could just say, let's respect one another, that does not acknowledge, that does not address these structures that I say we've constructed for generations, and the cultural reality that they create in our lives.
So are you saying, but this is where it gets, this is where I think people get caught up. You said before that you don't ascribe to that binary choice. And yet we have to hold that binary choice in our consciousness and in our hands. So what is the bridge?
Yeah, well, I don't think we can't simply ignore it, right? And because we're not in politics, we don't act as individuals. The nature of politics is not to act as an individual. One can be a leader, but one is leading a large group of people, and large groups of people are motivated, act on, I think history is the instinct of large groups, right? And if we're not aware of the group, the collective instinct that evolves out of its history, then the group is going to act in ways that are illogical, against its interests, that belie the simple suggestion to simply respect one another, because the large group is not a rational entity. And so, you know, if we're going to address these interpersonal forces, we have to take into consideration the larger instinct of groups as it's been constructed throughout history.
Yes, without, however, allowing ourselves to be driven into the divide and conquer. Because to me, I think the whole history of racism in America has been there for many reasons, for, you know, the economic development of a ruling class, but also very much to divide and conquer.
Yeah.
You know,
the white working class from the circumscribed labor as blacks.
Exactly. So I guess I'd like to ask you, is it, you know, can we say in the same breath that we want to address racial injustice as historically and currently manifested at the same time that we address economic injustice of all?
I think they're the same thing. I don't think there is a difference.
Okay.
You know, so one of the realizations that I had in writing this book is that you can't talk about labor in America without talking about slavery. You know, slavery is the foundational labor organization in American history. I think about the irrational responses that people have toward organized labor, and how very often, you know, that is contextualized by our racial fears and animosities. Race has always been used as a way, as you say, to divide and conquer. It's been used as a threat that this group is going to take resources from you, and therefore you need to protect yourself from this group. And so I see race and labor and economics as inseparable. There is no way to, and I think that it's folly, actually, to try and talk about race as purely a social issue without talking about its economic components.
Well, that is so interesting. Gregory Pardlow, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about this terrific memoir, Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. Highly recommend it to all our listeners. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Gregory Pardlow. Read an excerpt from Air Traffic at writersvoice.net. New York State might be poised to pass the most ambitious climate change plan in the country. The Climate and Community Protection Act, or CCPA, would eliminate 100% of human-caused CO2 pollution in New York State by 2050 from all sectors, transportation, buildings, energy. The bill not only mandates an economy-wide shift to renewables, but also sends resources to vulnerable frontline communities and establishes supports for workers in current fossil fuel jobs as the state transitions away from them. Several months ago, I interviewed economist Robert Pollan of the University of Massachusetts, who wrote an economic analysis of how the CCPA could actually be implemented. I interviewed him for another radio show I co-produce called Sustainable East End. It airs on WPKN that serves Southern Connecticut and Eastern Long Island. At the time, passage of the CCPA looked like a long shot. But with Senator Chuck Schumer endorsing it this week, it's clear support is growing. So I thought it would be a good idea to bring my interview with Pollan to my Writer's Voice audience. Robert Pollan wrote a famous study of green jobs that President Obama used in developing his stimulus plan of 2009. Now, 10 years later, down the road to climate emergency, Pollan says the goals of the Climate and Community Protection Act are very ambitious, but they are achievable. So This prepares a policy framework for supporting investments in throughout the state. First, tell us what the current state of investments are and where they need to be to achieve the goal. I believe you have a 2030 goal, and then you have a 2050 goal of 100%. What is the 2030 goal?
50%. 50% cut in emissions relative to when I was writing the paper, which is 2017. So roughly 50% relative to today, and 100% by 2050.
100% cut in emissions. You're saying zero emissions.
Yeah, down to zero emissions. Right. Yeah.
That is. Okay, so we're not just talking about 100% renewable energy, we're talking about 100%.
Yeah, no, that's different. You're right. So, yeah, a zero emissions economy by 2050, which is achievable.
When you say zero emissions, does that mean that whatever people are emitting is going to be taken up by some balancing act?
I'm saying zero emissions, like not zero net emissions. Which is, you know, better than nothing, of course, wherein we have positive emissions, but then, well, let's say we increase the forest coverage in the state, which will increase absorption of CO2. That's positive. I'm all for that. But I'm saying no, and I should say I'm not in the study. I focused on carbon dioxide, CO2 emissions. So I'm not talking about methane. I'm not talking about nitric oxide, other two large sources of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's a shortcoming of the study. So I'm focusing on carbon dioxide from energy. So basically burning coal, natural gas, and oil to produce energy in New York State. And the goal, therefore, is to have no energy production through the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas, so that all energy would come from clean, renewable sources and from increasing efficiency of the existing infrastructure of the state.
So this is electricity generation, or does it include transportation fuels?
Both transportation and electricity.
And this would mean everybody's driving electric cars.
It means everybody's driving electric cars, or of course using public transportation that runs on electricity. Or you can have liquid fuels from bioenergy, and that I think is going to be a modest supplemental contributor to the overall energy mix as of 2050. Right now, you know, we have fairly significant amount of bioenergy running transportation vehicles, but it's corn ethanol. Corn ethanol is a dirty energy source. The way it's produced, it's roughly equivalent to burning coal. So corn ethanol is no solution. But if you utilize bioenergy from agricultural wastes and you refine that energy through renewable energy sources as opposed to fossil fuel energy sources, then you can have clean bioenergy. So that's what I mean by clean bioenergy.
Well, that's really exciting. I'm talking with Robert Pollan of the Political Economy Research Institute at UMass Amherst about his study of how New York State can implement a Green New Deal that will create hundreds of thousands of new jobs and make New York fossil fuel free by 2050. Let's talk about the investment then. What level of investment do we have, and where do we need to be to accomplish this?
New York State, first of all, I should say, New York State needs to improve a lot, but New York State is the cleanest state in the United States relative in terms of emissions, CO2 emissions per capita. New York State is better than every other state in the country, as it is. And there's two big reasons for that. One is that you do have a lot of hydropower, and two is that you have a highly efficient energy infrastructure relative to other states, and that is mainly due to the energy infrastructure in New York City. So New York City, where most people live in apartment buildings that are much more energy efficient than private residential living, and that you have a lot of public transportation in New York City and the environs around it. So that, you know, New York State is already pretty good, very good relative to the rest of the country, but you still have a ways to go. So what I estimated was that it's a fairly simple kind of project conceptually. We're talking about expanding renewable energy supply and raising energy efficiency standards beyond where they already are. And while that happens, we also let fossil fuel energy consumption decline by about 2-3% a year. So the level of investment needed to hit these targets of a 50% cut by 2050 and a 100% cut in emissions by 2050. So we have the 2030 goal, 50%, 2050, 100%, is on the order of 2% of the state's GDP, actually a little less, 1.8% of GDP every year gets invested in raising the energy efficiency levels, investing in things like more public transportation, especially in the outer, you know, outside of New York City, investing in, subsidizing the purchase of electric cars, in industrial production using so-called combined heat and power systems so that we don't waste the energy used for generating electricity. We reuse it as heat. Those kinds of things can be extremely valuable, improving the insulation in residential homes, simple things like that. So that's very important. And then in addition to that, building up the supply of solar power, wind power, geothermal power. I don't think there's much room to expand hydropower, but those would be the main components of the project.
And this would also mean retiring nuclear plants, power plants?
Yeah, well, I didn't suggest any expansion of nuclear power. And then, yes, there already are plans to retire the existing stocks, at least some of the stock of nuclear power. So basically what we called for is just allowing that rate of decline of nuclear supply to continue and increasingly rely on these renewable energy sources.
Right now, Bob Pollan, the state and private companies are investing between $7 and $8 billion a year in renewables. But you say we need to get to almost $9 billion per year in energy efficiency and $22 billion per year in clean renewable energy. Now, that comes to a total of clean energy investments of about $31 billion a year. Where is this money going to come from?
Well, first of all, when we say it in the absolute dollars, it sounds gigantic. $31 billion is a lot of money, but it's less than 2% of state GDP for New York State. So when we frame it that way, you know, it's saying 98% of all the activity, economic activity in the state can proceed more or less as it is, if that's what people want to do. But we do have to channel 2% or 1.8% into this project. So the sources of funding, well, we are going to raise money through the polluter's fee, and that will raise some of it. And so we have a new source of public investment and a source of funding for private investors. The other funding will come from the private sector. And there's no reason why we wouldn't expect private sector investment, because this is going to be the energy source for the state. And if we also have regulations which are supposed to limit the fossil fuel consumption for the state, and those limits get stricter every year, then their private sector should have every incentive they need to, you know, to push the money into building up the green economy.
So you talked about a polluter fee. It's going to start at $35 per ton in 2021, according to this analysis. I mean, that's what you would be, I guess, in the act, right?
Yeah.
And it would rise to $75 per ton as of 2030. So is this going to be passed on to the consumer, or is there a way to ensure that it won't hit the middle and low income New Yorkers too hard?
The way to absolutely ensure it is basically to raise the money and then give it back to the consumers. And we propose that some of the funds that are generated by the fee be returned, especially to the lower income households, so they won't face any additional cost whatsoever. From their standpoint, the point of the polluter fee is to encourage people to switch into renewable energy and efficiency, which will be cheaper. But to the extent they still rely on fossil fuel energy, they get the money back by redistributing some of the tax revenues. Beyond that, for the upper income households, keep in mind that we are investing in energy efficiency for the state, which will make all their energy consumption cheaper, because that's the meaning of energy efficiency. You get the same energy services with less energy usage. And then also keep in mind that we are transitioning the economy to renewables. So to the extent that the upper income households shift into renewables through their, say, having an electric car as opposed to a fossil fuel engine car, you know, that will also mean that they are not facing the polluter fee at all.
I can tell you, my son just recently bought a Nissan Leaf.
Oh.
And he's an Uber driver. And he is finding that he's saving basically $500 a month that he was spending on gasoline is that's gone away, and it's paying for his monthly payment on the car.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. So, when we switch, you know, electric cars, and, you know, and part of the program that we propose for New York State is to subsidize the purchase of electric cars. And now, electric cars don't do us a whole lot of good if the electricity is generated by coal. So, you know, we need the buildup of the renewable electricity sector to be an important integral part of this process, so that when people have the electric cars, the electricity comes from renewable energy.
That was economist Robert Pollan talking with me in January about his economic analysis of how to implement the Climate and Community Protection Act in New York State. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.